Hello and welcome to the Managing Uncertainty podcast. I'm Brian Strauser, Principal and Chief Executive here at BrightPath. In this week's episode, I have an interview with Ian Hay. Ian Hay is a longtime emergency manager who has worked in this space since getting motivated to enter emergency management and homeland security as a profession after the events of September 11th. He was working in Syracuse, New York, around the time of September 11th and entered this space because of the events of that day. Right after the founding of the Office of Homeland Security by then Pennsylvania Governor Tom Ridge, at the request of President George W. Bush, Ian was the founding president of one of the first public-private partnerships that was established for information sharing. He was the president of the Southeast Emergency Response Network based out of Atlanta, Georgia, which is where Ian was when I met him nearly 18 years ago. Ian and I talk about a number of topics, including public-private partnerships, effective emergency management exercises, and the future of the Federal Emergency Management Agency. Without further ado, here is my interview with Ian Hay. All right, with me today is Ian Hay. Ian, let's start with your story. Tell us a little bit about your background, education, how you wound up in this field of homeland security and emergency management.
Sure thing. First of all, Brian, thank you for having me today. And also thank you for being one of our first Emergency Management External Affairs Association members.
Of course.
So appreciate that. And so, you know, my story is very typical of a lot of people in that time where I stumbled into it.
That was kind of my story as well. But yeah, how did you wind up here?
Right. So, you know, obviously, and I know we'll probably get deeper into this later, but obviously I watched with horror during 9/11 as that second plane came into the tower. And I actually have the Cable Express mug that I was drinking out of right as the second plane tore through the tower. And I was just standing there. And so I knew that I had to do something for my country. And it took a couple of years. However, shortly into 2003, I volunteered and was recruited to basically be a translator between the red tape of government and the bleeding red ink of private sector. And so we had the G8 summit come to town and obviously had a lot of critical infrastructure and big, you know, iconic American company, company's footprint. And you also have to remember that was the first G8 summit post 9/11. Mm-hmm. And so it was obviously going to have a very different security profile.
And that G8 summit, that was in Atlanta or near Atlanta.
Yeah, Sea Island.
On the coast. Yeah, Sea Island. That's right. That's right. Yeah. Where were you on 9/11? What were you doing at the time?
I was in Syracuse, New York.
Okay.
I was in Atlanta, Georgia, but okay. I had worked for a company in Syracuse, New York, Cable Express.
Okay.
And so I actually had been a New York resident, which, you know, as a Bostonian, tough for me, but alas. And watched the plane tear into that second tower on the phone with a couple of people. You know, what I didn't know at the time is that the terrorists had used my hometown of Boston as a launching pad for their attack.
Mm-hmm.
And that really pissed me off. And so there was no way I was going to let the same fate be suffered in my new home state of Georgia. Little did I know, these guys were learning how to fly, right? Not land, right nearby. I mean, 20 miles from my house. And so that, you know, that really altered my entire career trajectory. And so I looked for ways to get involved. I immediately talking with two different recruiters and wish I had spoken with a local recruiter. I was going to go Navy Intel. And, you know, I used to bench 365. I was a big, meaty, you know, football guy. And they're like, yeah, your weight's too high. I'm like, just meet with me. Right. And of course, I wanted to do it through a Boston recruiter. I kept trying to get somebody locally. That didn't work out. And I think that was, you know, ordained. Like that's the way this was going to go, to force me into this bizarre role that no one else was really doing. And it takes a particular, you know, a particular kind of character to be an ombudsperson for everybody, right? To not let one silo win or one agency win over the other, but to really create a new language for Homeland Security communication.
So 9/11 kind of changed your career path a little bit.
Absolutely.
What you're, yeah. So what'd you wind up
100%
doing?
redirection.
Yeah. So what'd you wind up doing after 9/11?
So I applied for, be a federal air marshal and did the Navy recruiting thing and the whole nine. And then finally, I met someone at a networking event and of 100 Army intel people, 98 go to counterterror, two go to espionage, and I got groomed by somebody who did espionage. And so I'll never forget it. I get invited to a meeting and where I'm dressed down, right? It's a technology company doing a little business casual. And as well, and he says to me, "Ian, we're not going to lunch. We're going into a meeting." I'm like, "Am I about to meet the governor? What the hell is going on here?" Right? And I end up going to this meeting, and it's all private sector. It's all big, iconic, local private sector. And we talk about we don't know where the 80% came from, right? We still don't know, like, who came up with this 80% critical infrastructure thing. But that was what we were there to do, was to really communicate with all the people who held all the critical infrastructure and to make sure we had a partnership. Because there's no way that 20% can defend all that without a partnership. And so, what happened from there? Well, activated for the G8 summit, actually ran a down room for 70 undercover agents where they could get off, get out of the heat, off their feet, somewhere to rest. But was, I got the call, and friends of mine go like, "Dude, you're going to the show," right? As a baseball guy, it was a big deal. But here I am. I'm deployed to Savannah. I'm doing a morning briefing, sharing information across different federal agencies, big iconic private sector, sort of the belly button between private sector and the state. One of the first guys detailed to a fusion center, position of trust, background, the whole nine. And it was incredibly effective. And what did it do? It allowed our private sector folks to send some of their people home early, right? I'll never forget a big retailer, not one that you worked for. I know this is really tough to figure out who it is. And we're all sitting in their little security room and like, "Hey, yeah, we saw you have a new building over there." Like, we're not worried about that. We're worried about our customers and our associates. That's all we care about. Like, we have insurance for that. And you could just see that altered the whole thinking in the room. And so now I've got, 10 to 15, state employees, law enforcement, who now understand a bit better about private sector. And of course, private sector doesn't have limits on information that it can hold or store or whatever. And so they were an incredible benefit for, for anyone who needed information. We're all tracking a lot of the same people, right? Folks who want to cover their face. And thankfully we have the Georgia mask law. So anywho, long-winded answer to your conversation, but that's basically how I volunteered, recruited, got groomed, and then I'm in the thick of it. And then, of course, the next thing that happens, Secretary Ridge launches four information sharing pilots in the country. I got the Southeast. And because we had the 96 Games bombing, law enforcement was really well connected in this area. And so that allowed me to sort of en masse approach that group now that I was vetted and I'd proven myself at G8. And so I was just the natural guy. I was the inaugural president, and we just kept cruising, and it was a 3,000 person membership. We're doing alerting like way ahead of its time. So yeah, it was a 100%, 100% change in direction of my career, and I loved every minute of it. I m obviously met folks such as yourself and many, many others, and learned a whole bunch of different languages.
I was gonna say, so you, from there, you were one of the first, or you were leading one of the first, information sharing networks. So you were the inaugural president of CERN, the Southeast Emergency Response Network. So let's talk a
That's
little
correct.
bit about, what those initial, what was that initial organization look like? What did that initially look like? What were your goals? How'd that kind of come together?
Yeah,
As Ridge stood up that first office of Homeland Security.
Oh yeah, I mean, like the directorship in a closet in the White House, right? I mean, this and that's what people don't realize. Like, there was no structure,
There was nothing.
and so and I would say one caveat to that. So, basically, what we did as a nation is we looked for capability, and we simply went into counter-narcotics and turned all those people into counter-terror largely overnight. Like within 10 days of 9/11, we were taking the best and brightest out of, who had just been, who had been doing counter-narcotics and what have you, and they were now counter-terror, and they were getting, trained up really quickly. So anyway, so Ridge launches these pilots, but the initial pilot was in the Southwest, called the Southwest version of, Emergency Response Network. There was one in Seattle called NWARN, the Northwest Warning and Alert Network. Indiana, which I think, is that your home state?
It is.
I gotta say, had a great acronym, buddy. It was, IAN, the Indiana Alert Network, and they piloted that as a state just to see if it would deploy differently than a FEMA region. And then I had the last of the four originals, which was the Southeast Emergency Response Network. We were already connected to the Georgia Fusion Center. I had already been connected to the entire Southeast Fusion Center group that met. We provided coffee for those, for those meetings, because these folks were, driving at 3 a.m. to get to this meeting. It was, unbelievable at that time, doing so much more with less. Anyway, so Ridge launches these pilots. They stand up. The original formation was, very straight, which is like, hey, look, you get to create your own governance. Had a national program. I think there were about 22,000 people in that program. And the whole goal was, it was a horizontal crosscut. So if the white van shows up to the power company, we should probably be telling the dam sector and the water sector and anywhere else where they may start to test security, right? And so we could send something in a vertical, but it was really designed to be horizontal crosscut. So we would take raw information and alert people. They could feed back. They could then, start looking into, oh, hey, that license plate has showed up, at my venue, or we are checking this, right? And then we did everything from local to state to, regional to national types of threats. In the early days, the DHS open source report, that thing had meat. I mean, that was a great document. And then, of course, people were just handing it to the press, and so that ended that game, right?
Definitely has changed over
So,
time.
yep. And then I'm trying to think what else would be helpful. And so these all stood up in their various geographics, and then over time, we transitioned both from a Homeland Security information sharing mission to into emergency management. So I used to attend the FEMA regional risk meetings, and would sit behind the state directors. And so I had a first name basis with people like Brock Long. If you remember, he was head of Alabama, and all these, all
Later
these great
FEMA administrator.
directors. Exactly. And all these great directors that I learned emergency management from real time, right? So it, and then of course I was also involved, our good friend Joe Catalino was at NORTHCOM. They were always leaning forward. And so I learned all the military jargon, right? So that with the language, I just kept on picking up languages. I spoke private sector. I learned to speak state, then realized, oh, there's a whole different intel language. There's a whole military, right? If you don't speak jargon or can manage the jargon, you're in trouble. You're going to get lost in those meetings. Even though what we ideally want is to speak plain language, right? And we'll talk more about that, obviously, if we dig into exercises. But what else can I tell you about it, that sort of heady, the
Well,
heady time
so
there?
this was new, right? It was maybe a little easier in the Southeast because, as you said, you had the Olympics and you had the Olympic bombing in 1996. So there was a little bit of a forced partnership because folks had to come together during that investigation and to protect the Olympics. And then right after 9/11, you had the G8, as you mentioned. But these kind of public-private partnerships, this was a really new concept after 9/11. both in terms of what you had to put together there and even the Olympic Public Safety Command out in Salt Lake City for the 2002 Winter Games. Those were kind of a new way of thinking about this. What kind of challenges did you see having to get that off the ground?
Yeah, so I'm so glad. It's like I'm so scarred by some of it. I actually forgot to talk about. No, I'm kidding.
It's okay.
But no, some of it's true. However, look, InfraGuard existed, but they weren't doing stuff on an operational level,
Right.
right? We would talk about cyber threat. Maybe something would come up. You've got office creepers, or it would. What this program did is it blended ASIS, right? The building owners, BOMA, the Building Owners and Managers Association. And so it brought these big associations that were ducked into private sector and really helped create that communication flow. And so this was really, what I personally did was really get private sector involved in a pre, right? I'm a left of boom guy. So we do a pre-brief, we help share with them what to look for. We tell them what we are looking for so we can get real sharing. And the moment somebody shares, then it's right. That first phone call that my mentor had with one of America's most iconic companies altered the, he's like, this was the right thing to do by our private sector partners. And I actually was like, whoa. And so, yeah, this was absolutely the Wild West. I remember when I would, when I was doing my outreach to get CERN known, I remember meeting with a particular group, right? These were all folks who wanted to be cops and couldn't be. And, well, why are you doing that? What's in it for you? And just like all this, like, just nasty beating on my, what my personal objectives were. And I'm like, look, man, JFK said, ask not what your country can do for you. What can you do for your country? And I realized we were outgunned on 9/11. And so why not use my capability of networking and being able to learn these, different modalities very quickly and basically be a neutral arbiter? And if you look at the best associations throughout the country, right? When you were in your role, it didn't just have to benefit Target. You would support something so people could actually communicate. I remember being at a couple of those meetings, and they altered the entire ball game. I mean, I remember we had a coordination meeting like, hey, we can't just give that away. We're not going to be a government. We're not going to be subject to the government's, the way we do our financials. Well, why don't you just give it to the Red Cross? Right? Why don't you just give it to the Red Cross? And I remember just like being in that meeting, I'm like, wow. Use the appropriate tool, use the partner that can get you what you need. And it was amazing. It was an amazing time to be at the forefront. And I joke about this, but there are probably somewhere between 200 and 600 people that have government jobs because of a category that I helped create.
Yeah, I mean,
Right.
this whole idea of these kind of public-private partnerships and these kind of information sharing relationships didn't really exist like this prior to 9/11. Which really leads me to that whole next category of questions that we wanted to talk about, which was one of the things that was created in this post-9/11 era was the, or is rather, FEMA's Office of the Private Sector, which now has a different name. But our friend Dan Stone King really helped turn this into something unique, where it was less about how to help companies do business with FEMA and more about how FEMA could share information and consume information to help strengthen the resilience of the nation and help companies help local communities reopen more quickly than before. So I know you and I were both involved in some of these efforts. What's your perspective on how that office has helped support preparedness and engagement over the years?
Yeah, so there is no one like Dan Stone King. Dan is
No.
a pusher. Dan gets stuff done. He gets ahead of you and leaves the office, and you're still in his wake, right? And so I don't know if that will ever achieve the same level. We'll see. Because really what I'm alluding to is with all these people who have these jobs in government is the government stepped into our business and it drove many people like me out of the business. And so, and if you look at, are we safer? Are we more safe than we were at 9/11? No, the threats are there. They're just actually closer, right? It's much more of an internal threat. So back to the question at hand, so when Dan comes in and I can attest, like when I first started to move into that emergency management realm, they were all terrified of wearing orange, right? Oh, hey, we got to separate private sector from, from acquisition and somebody who's, supposed to do that. And I'm like, no, we're talking operational information. We're not talking about deals or, work they can do. So that was a big step. And Dan was, really helpful in getting that kickstarted. I remember, I was activated and we were dealing with Katrina. And we went to DC and we went to do briefings and, we could tell people where bottled water was within 5 miles of a zip code. And there were folks at FEMA didn't want to talk to us. And there were, and then finally we found a couple of people who were like, oh, wow, I can use this. And somebody deployed like 17,000 resources. This was called the National Emergency Resource Registry. It was a piece of software that hung on our platform, never been tested, right? We field tested it in Katrina. Never a good idea. But this thing was gaining 10,000 units of something an hour. Like that's how powerful it was. And so, and you know how government works, right? So you got people who are saying, hey, I've got this resource available and it's free, but it needs to be picked up, right? I'm not shipping it to you. Hey, I have this resource and I'm willing to sell it to you at cost. Or I have this and, right. And so you get this kludge of all thing, it's not easy. It's like what happens in, regular disasters when people start sending winter coats and it becomes, you actually have to appoint somebody to deal with it and it's not helping the operation, right? So, and then so government kind of turned on that and they wanted to create a come up with a new, software, what have you. So really Dan was just a great, point of connection. And then from that, right, we launched the National, Business Emergency Operations Center, of which CERN was a founding member. And that was spectacular. I mean, it really consolidated a lot of information sharing. You could jump on these calls. I could tell you the last two calls that I attended, and this is quite a ways back, but they were incredibly effective. A lot of good information sharing, real street level stuff, and then people offering different capabilities. So I don't know because I'm not in this business anymore. I don't, really attend a lot of meetings, but I can tell you from my peers, we all feel the same way. We're not doing what we were doing, right? The access is nowhere near what it used to be. And I know a couple of DoD counterparts who are like, we used to meet quarterly or we used to meet every 2 months or we used to have great access. I don't know that that's really happening now. And so, and obviously recently, CISA was just, FEMA CISA, it's all, we're just holding on,
There's a
holding on
lot
to see
going
what
on over
happens
there right
next.
now.
Yeah, a lot going on over there.
Yeah,
A lot going on.
I haven't attended. We don't have clients that today have impact where we would be participating in the roles that my company has. But at least during COVID, we were still attending calls that the private sector office and others were coordinating during the time. But it's changed since then. So I'm not sure exactly what's going on there.
But I mean, Dan launched the first, public-private sector conference. That was outstanding. A lot of great information sharing, right? That kept going for several years. I think they'd still do it.
So
And I know they
that
do
was
it.
going
Go ahead.
on until this year.
Was it?
It was
Okay. So at this time.
canceled with the new administration, with all of the
Yeah.
changes that are going on.
Yeah, makes total sense. And they also did a regional component, so that makes sense why I haven't heard, why I haven't heard anything from the regional component either.
So, yeah, I don't know. We're going to talk more about the future of FEMA at the end
Sure.
here, where we think that's going. I want to shift gears and talk a little bit about exercises. You've spent a lot of time involved in various exercises, locally, regionally, nationally over the years. What in your view makes for a great emergency management exercise?
So you got to have a lot of willing players. And I'm a very lucky guy, right? My first introduction to an exercise, we blew up a local MARTA station.
Always
It
good to
was
start with a bang.
right. I mean, and it was a really private sector directed, good friend of mine, Ed Davalos. I think he was with Sprint at the time, and kind of led the charge and got everybody involved. And I really learned a lot. So I got a taste for it there. And then I had the great fortune of meeting Derek Rowan, who was probably one of the most gifted exercise and practitioners and trainers. He serves on the HCP Doctrine Committee, whatever that's called. And what I love about working with him and the folks on his team is we bring realism into exercises unlike any other group I've been a part of. I remember my first exercise with him, and spending 90 minutes chatting with a New York firefighter who responded on 9/11. And we were just like, yeah, well, how would they do this, and how would that show up, and then what would happen, just to create that type of realism, down to a printer cable that had to be delivered, via police vehicle, or getting the number of capstone and national level exercises that we've been part of. So I'm always part of that kind of sim cell. So we simulate that information that makes people act, right? So I always love, I'm always in the other branch. That's where the land of misfit toys goes, and the reconstitution of the United States government, which I love, right? So I carry three copies of the Constitution with me. I carry our documents, and so that I could reform the federal government at any point. But no, the realism in exercises, allowing people to test, right, their policy or operation. And one of the places I've been really vested in since about 2010, 2012 is in creating that space where people can test their social media and alerting capabilities. So what do you mean? Well, like, how do you, because we learned early. We were doing this in 2005. Yeah. So we would like, all right, who on Twitter is giving us the best information? And you follow those people, right? And then what government is the best at getting information out? Great, we're following those people. And then we are contributing, right, whatever information we have cleansed, so that we're protecting our sources. And so imagine creating that. And so Derek created a space in which, for clients to exercise that component inside of an ongoing exercise. And it's awesome. I mean, it really helps the client. And one time I got to serve as a governor and handed out coins, and was told by the deputy director, I won't quote him exactly, but he was like, that was real as. And so that was great to just be a part of that and to really push the limits. And I remember another time we were doing a hospital exercise, and somebody released X number of dead. And my person who was doing social media says, is that my mother? And I immediately went, oh, like, oh God, right? This is the end with the client. And so I immediately go to my boss, and I'm like, hey. And he goes, that's real. Like, somebody would say that, right? Somebody would absolutely say that. And so I was monitoring the policy group, and they're like, hey, at the end of this, we got to have a policy. Like, we can't ever be caught like that again.
That's right.
And so that type of realism alters the entire trajectory of response, right? And so that's why you have to do these things. You've got to do them so that you can test those individual, and I'm sitting here in that entire time, Brian, we never did a pandemic exercise. I mean, we had bird flu, we had swine flu, we had, pl and I'm sure HHS was doing it over there, but I never participated in a local, regional, national pandemic exercise until we were in it, man. And I, of course, was yesterday was the anniversary of my deployment 5 years ago.
Yeah, look, it's the same thing here, right? I came after 3 years away from crisis management. I came back into crisis management in a leadership role at my former employer in 2009 because of H1N1. I got pulled back into the role early because I wasn't supposed to enter it until 2010. Led the company through H1N1, stayed in that role until 2014, and then I left and started my business. We didn't run a single pandemic exercise. We get to 2020, of course. I'm in London for grad school on a trip for a week and a half. I come back. I am in Boston at one of our clients at the time, being led by someone you and I know in common. I was like, hey, man, I was just in London and all they're talking about is COVID. And we went and saw his chief HR officer and we're like, this is going to be bad. It's going to be here in a couple of weeks. It's going to be really bad. And like nobody had done any pandemic exercises. I got Michael Osterholm in my backyard, one of the US's foremost pandemic experts at the University of Minnesota. Nobody here was doing any pandemic exercises. We'd all had turned a blind eye to that. And then here we were, COVID
Well, and
five
then
years ago.
somebody, and then I'm doing research, and I'm like, where's the after action report? Like, where, what is going on? And I'll dig into that in a second with exercises, but I didn't even know, like, there was an 1800 pandemic. Like, we should have been prepared for this.
1918, don't
And
forget that.
well, but that's my point, is that not only I was looking for the after action report from the Spanish flu, right? Thank goodness they were the only ones talking about it, because nobody else was. And we're moving all kinds of, troop transport at the absolute worst time, and I loved, hearing the stories of, oh yeah, well, we went back and we looked at satellite footage and we saw that the Chinese hospitals were overwhelmed because their parking lots were full. I'm just going
And
like,
that's
holy
all
cow.
we do.
Well, but here's what's crazy, Brian, right? I would not have paid attention to this until Adam Silver shut down the NBA. Like, I was peripherally paying attention to it. I traveled that February. I asked the Delta gate agent. I was like, this plane didn't come from China, right? No, sir, you're fine. But I'm also going to LA. I'm like, man, that's like the two places you don't want to be in this thing are LA and New York,
So
right?
we was it about this time? So spring break 2020, just to bring that story home about the NBA. We're taking, so my kids are off for a week. My wife and I are going, we're leaving for Florida to go to Legoland. So
Nice.
near Orlando, what is it's in it's near Jupiter, I think, right? So you
I
fly to
think so.
Orlando, you drive like an hour. So we're in the gateway. I'm sorry, we're in the terminal, I mean, sorry. We're in the gate area having breakfast. And I think that's when the NBA came on and said that they were canceling the season. And we're like, should we get on the plane? And we're like, well, yeah, let's get on the plane. So we get on the plane, we fly down there, we get to Legoland. The first day we're there, the park is open, everything's fine. The second day we're there, Disney World is like, we're going to close at the end of the week.
Right.
And we're like, huh. The third day we're there, they're like, we're closing the water. Legoland has a water park. They're like, we're going to close the water park after tomorrow. And we're like, interesting. So we go to the water park. We're like the only ones there.
Yeah, because everybody
I mean,
else is
it was
terrified.
cool. We had the water park to ourselves, but it was
It's
kind of
awful.
creepy because we had the water park to ourselves.
Let me tell you, when I arrived at that airport like 5 years ago, ghost town.
In where
Five
were you?
cars. I just because of the contract, I'm not allowed to
Oh,
say,
okay,
but
that's fine.
no, and we're
Understood.
fine. But no, I mean, there were five cars. I mean, imagine a major metropolitan airport with five cars. And of course, thankfully, we could still do rideshare. So everybody's masked up and everything. And yeah, I mean, it was an absolute crazy time, but it wasn't until Adam Silver shut down the NBA that I really started to pay attention. And then, of course, I was deployed for Joint Information Center and a lot of information sharing, and I'm watching, and we're posting hand washing, by country, and essentially these things just crossed in the United States, right? We got the U flu that went through Europe and got worse. We had the Wu flu that came west to east, and it just crisscrossed the United States. And obviously the big population centers just took a beating. I mean, I remember I'd been, because I'm getting all the Facebook notifications, and a mutual friend of ours, Bob Connors, who's actually just retired. Is he retired? He's edging toward retirement, if not retired. And he's like, hey, if you've been in New York, you have to quarantine for 2 weeks or whatever it was at the time. And so this is really, where the rubber met the road. This is where things really started to take off and things started to shut down and people got a lot more serious about wearing masks. And it's a crazy time. It's absolutely crazy time.
So one of the things you mentioned that I wanted to ask about was, lessons learned after action reports. Here we think that this is an area where folks just don't take advantage of the opportunity to really learn and, move forward with changes that improve your capabilities for the next time, or as I like to say, make new original mistakes in the next crisis. What have you seen, with the lessons learned or after action process coming out of an exercise,
So, I
or a
mean,
real disaster as we're talking about here?
so we're gonna move to divide the question, and I'll talk about real exercises, and I'll talk
Sure.
about real-world and then exercises. Remember, I'm blessed, right? I work for Derek Rowan inside of Accentra, all super capable people in their own right, but we also adhere to ICS doctrine. We don't do this ICS light, right? We have our objectives. What's our strategy? What are our tactics? Hey, this isn't working. Change tactics. And then, right, we're key on evaluation. We were one of the best who do evaluations, and we capture all this stuff. We look at it, build, what are the gaps? Build the plan, train to fill those gaps, and then you either retest or recert or whatever it is. And so I'm blessed in that regard, in that I grew up in learning that ICS language and learning that I can take a as a when I was deployed, I'm like, hey, give me that invoice. I know to walk over to the finance section and get the right person and get this paid so that the person I'm working for doesn't have to be doing this knucklehead stuff, right? That's what I came here to take off their plate. Second, because I understand that process, I'm able to escalate things through ICS. Like if this needs to go up to the next layer of command, then we get both people and we go up and we have the discussion, we get an answer, right? So we move faster inside of that model. We're all heavily, Homeland Security exercise program trained. So we speak in that same, the National Incident Management System and how that shows up in a regional and national exercise. Now to real world, right? Real world during Katrina, we learned a lot of great stuff, but if it's not captured and then it's not indoctrinated, then you're going to make, as you said, you're going to make the same mistake next time. And the thing that really drove me crazy is we've got Hurricane Pam, a Cat 3, right, sitting in a binder in that office in Louisiana. Nobody cracked that sucker because it would have told you what to do. And again, this what people don't realize is the size of Katrina was it was it's the size of Great Britain. That, that's 55 million people, right? That's not at the time. Right. And so you have to get scale. And that we have known people who think we just rappel from a helicopter and flip the power back on.
That's all
That's
it
not the way it
takes.
works, right? That's not the way it works in critical infrastructure. Right. You've got to restore it, test it, certify it, and so I think that it's really the blending of those two. Because what you could do in an exercise is, oh, every bridge needs to be recertified in an earthquake. Okay, notionally, we get it. We've done it once. We know what that process is going to look like every time there's a major aftershock. We don't need to keep doing it again. Fast forward 24 hours or 36 or, right, a week, 2 weeks. And then what does recovery look like? What does long-term recovery look like? And so that's, so in many ways, I'm lucky. To both have been trained exceptionally well to have been right at the forefront. I mean, I ended up testifying on the 5th anniversary of 9/11 about information, information flow and sharing in our program. And so we were able to kind of get stuff done that a lot of other organizations couldn't get done, right? We had access to I was very well known amongst most of the fusion centers. I went to the fusion center conference several years in a row and got to know those people, got them on, we had a novel alerting platform, and we added to that, and it was also our access, right? If you have the right people in the room to give you great, consulting, then you're able to reduce that and share it. And it's really in, and this is when, like, it's so funny because I've been recording some of this recently in the last 6 months, and just how things bubble up. And I remember saying something, and like, that's not landing. I'm like, I'm gonna just shut up for a second. And if you get two cops together, they got to find somebody in common. And until they find an operation that they did together, or they know somebody else, they're just like, "Hey, I ain't go, you know, not gonna, I'm not gonna trust you, but like, I'm gonna keep you here."
Yep.
But the moment they find that, right? You and I could we might not have talked in weeks, and somebody says, "Oh, okay," and because they know you and they were able to correctly share a story about you, I'd be like, "Okay, that person's vetted." Right? And that's just the way we operate as human beings. And to know that, to just shut up until that connection has happened. And then once that connection is made, now we can really have a meeting. Right? And I think that is one of those lessons learned that is lost in that whole outreach. Because there are great programs out there. But I couldn't tell you, firsthand the state of the state right now if you asked. Right.
There's a lot of conversation going on right now in this administration about the future of FEMA. I think it started in the middle of 2024 during Hurricane Helene, in the height of the presidential campaign, about, when we started to see some, I think, some disinformation spread about the hurricane response and the aid that folks were being provided and what was really going on with the hurricane. But even last week, we saw, Secretary Noem, Secretary of Homeland Security, saying we're going to begin dismantling FEMA. The president has issued an executive order with a task force looking at FEMA and what we should do with FEMA. We
Apologies.
don't have a FEMA administrator right now. We have an acting
Acting, we
administrator.
have an acting one.
We have an acting administrator. We don't have deputy administrators. We have senior officials performing the duties of the deputy administrator. So there's a lot of voices, suggesting we should just do away with FEMA and just give money to the states. So from your, I guess from your vantage point, what's driving that conversation?
Well, I mean, we're having a conversation about government efficiency, and I'm not going to be political about this. However, you actually have to go back to the founding of the United States, and the founding of the United States didn't want efficient government. It wanted elements and branches pitted against each other, and that was the only way to keep us safe, right? It's the only way to prevent a concentration of power or faction, passions and factions. And so while I understand we don't want to be wasteful with taxpayers' money, we're also not looking for completely efficient government. Because every time we hand over the reins with AI, it starts peeling a bunch of stuff off the web that we don't want. Right? And I'm sure you've seen the news stories about that. So I think you've always got to have a human being in the middle of that process. So I think where we find ourselves is let's go back to, ICS doctrine or HSEP doctrine. What are our objectives? What's our objective, right? If our objective is to meet the needs of people who have experienced a disaster, then that's our mission. Those are our objectives. Here's our strategy. Here are our tactics. And so on the one hand, there's a lot. I mean, I certainly see there's a lot of fat to be cut. I wouldn't even be I wouldn't be authorized to speak about the Department of Education, but like, hey, they've moved some of the food related things out of education and into Health and Human Services. That probably is a smart move, right? I mean, you're having people who deal with something more closely or should be than another department. And so I think, I understand looking for that, but I think you got to start with what your objectives are. And there's no question there was some just craziness going on during, both Helene and Milton. And I told people, I was like, look, if that storm had hit directly over Atlanta, we would have been without power for weeks. I mean, we were lucky where, and I hate to say that for the folks in North Carolina, but they really took it on the chin. And you had, there were a lot of scare tactics. We just don't have there's no place for that in emergency management. We've got to get clear on our objectives, and then you fund those objectives, right? And that's really in the realm of Congress, right? Congress has got to come up with those laws, that structure. And so I think we're holding on right now, right? We don't know what's going to happen next. The people in the people who are the players at hand don't necessarily know what's going to happen next. So I don't know if I got anywhere near an answer for you there, but I think we're just going to be in a flat spin for a while until we figure out what it is we really want.
If you were to reimagine FEMA today, what do you think we should keep? What should be changed? Do you have
I mean,
thoughts there or?
I've always been a left of boom guy, so I am
Yeah.
always going to be 70-30 on
Preparedness.
preparedness over response. And you have to be geared up for response. You have to be. However, if you have the preparedness taken care of, response is actually a lot less expensive. And one of the things, Brock Long, as administrator of FEMA, was all about, creating your disaster fund, getting your disaster kit, having the resources to take care of yourself for 3 to 10 days. This was standard fare in the 40s and 50s America, right? People built bomb shelters. People, I keep, you know, about, I keep disaster food for 3 to 6 months. If everybody's doing that, it makes everything a lot easier. So I think, really an answer to that is I would go left of boom. I would focus more on preparedness. But I also, in general, we've got to rebuild private sector and American manufacturing. And I've been talking about this for 15 years, right? Way, way before it became popular. I'm like, how do you, instead of having one hot water heater company that has, 70, 80, 90% of the market share, how do you build three of those, distribute them properly across the US so that if one fails, you can pick up the slack? And like, look what was going on with our power infrastructure. All this stuff was being purchased in China with a 6 to 18 month lead time. You got to go indigenous, right? And if you don't want to build it here, then create a partnership with Canada or Mexico and have it right inside that border so you can get direct access to it and you're not waiting on it for it to come across the Pacific. So yeah, I think that is where I think we need to go, is to determine our objectives, and then build a plan. And I'm a big fan of 18-month plans. So I remember sitting with the acting Secretary of Homeland Security, and I said, "Sir, I know that you've been in meetings where you get a whole bunch of people around the table, and you can see the answer clear as day. Like, what the way this has to go. And it will take 18 months to a couple years before everyone around that table sees the answer the same way you do." And he cackled. I mean, he actually cackled. And I think that government is meant to be slow. You want it to be methodical. You want it to consider all the options. It absolutely has to listen to the minority opinion. Because sometimes, like, oh yeah, that was 20% of our infrastructure. Take potash.
Potash.
Potash, like, what? Canada and Russia could cripple farmers by withholding potash. Like, I mean, just like single source, crush an entire economy, right? And so it's like you got to know what your threats are and then adjust to them. And so I think that is just as true of rebuilding our economy as it is, redesigning FEMA or rethinking FEMA. If you don't like something, great, but then study it, build a plan, execute that plan, right? And I know that there have been other successful executive branchers who turned everything off and then just listened to the squeaky wheel and then, okay, we're going to fix that, right? So, I mean, I heard crazy stories about state governments that didn't know how many vehicles were in their fleet. Right? So you turn off the gas cards and watch what happens. Right? And then, okay, well, now I know.
Now I know what vehicles I've got.
I've lost 200 cars. I have no idea where they are. Now we're starting from net, and then we build our plan. So I don't know. I hope I didn't get too convoluted there, but I think
No.
that's, let's go left of boom. Let's be prepared for anything, right? It's an all hazard. Like I heard all hazards the first time in years, a couple weeks ago. I'm like, ooh, look at that. We're going back to old doctrine. This stuff recycles, right?
Yeah. You've had a front row seat to some major shifts in the field over, 25 in the nearly 25 years since 9/11. If you're looking ahead, what do you think the next era of homeland security and emergency management looks like?
Oh, I mean, we couldn't have that conversation without AI. I mean, I tell every Gen Xer that I know, I was like, look, you need to be doing this 15 minutes every day, because if you don't learn that language, you'll be fundamentally unemployable by the end of the decade. No question. I would bet money on that. And you're seeing it, right? You're seeing that the government wants to make decisions through AI. I think that's a bad idea. I think you've got to have a human being in that, right? I don't ever want computer. I get the world of drones, but I want a pilot. I want a human being making that decision at the time that matters. And so I think it's going to be, what's the role of AI? What's the role of its supervision by human beings? I think it could be an awesome tool at like identifying waste and certainly corruption, right? Fraud is probably AI is probably great at discovering that sort of thing. We have to make sure that we're holding on to our compassion, and we have to have the flexibility of operating locally, right? The folks who went through what they went through in Florida, radically different than what they went through in the North Carolina mountains. A computer program will probably not resolve that, but a human being in concert with one will. What else? We're seeing militarization of space. Who knows where this economy is currently going? That has a real impact on threat. We've got, right? We have an internal threat in the country that could be destabilizing. So there's a lot going on. It's certainly no safer than it was, as I said earlier, at the beginning of 9/11. We also don't know what will happen with our environment. Most people don't realize we're coming out of the tail end of a ice age. The Earth is typically hotter. Do human beings have an impact on the absolute 100%? I'm not saying that. Don't write me. However, to not look at floating ferns in the Arctic Circle and growing wine in England and write that the Earth is typically hotter. So when people start talking that way, I say, you're a speciesist. They're like, what? You're a speciesist. It's like, you think human beings should rule the earth for the rest of the time. Go talk to the trilobites, right? Go talk to the dinosaurs. Doesn't look
Ask
good.
them how that's going.
Yeah,
The
exactly.
AI conversation is interesting. I occasionally get emails from grad students wanting to interview me about different topics they're writing dissertations on. And I get maybe a request every other month. Every request I got last year was about AI, about AI in crisis management and business continuity. And everyone was coming at it from some different, it was mostly about decision-making models, I think, or about detection of a crisis, through social media monitoring or through monitoring of other data that companies had internally. And then it was about decision making, about being able to process large amounts of information and be able to make a decision in a crisis. And they all came up with some interesting ideas, in their theses and dissertations. So.
No, I mean the two biggest things we know from Emergency Management External Affairs Association is AI and mis, dis, mal information, right? And so that's kind of, not that it's the undiscovered country, but we know the true impact that just pushing around. And I tell people, it's like that meme was created by Yuri, right? That meme that you're pushing around Facebook was created by our enemy to divide us. Stop it.
Yeah.
Just really just stop it. And it gets everybody all up in a fervor. And so, I think that those two things have to be dealt. Like those are the two, that's the undiscovered country as we look toward emergency management. And also responding in a more technical world. Right? As things become more automated, they are going to be more vulnerable in some regard.
Well, we'll have to end things there for the sake of time with this episode. Ian, thank you for coming on. I greatly appreciate you taking the time to share your thoughts.
Absolutely. This has been great. Certainly a fabulous walk down memory lane.
A good one. Absolutely. All right. Thank you, sir. That's it for this edition of the Managing Uncertainty podcast. I'll be back next week with another new episode. Be well.